All right, well, welcome to the Mary Heitkin Dumont University here at Anshei Sefer Beth Olmos Congregation, and to our discussion, the second in a three-part series about the mystics of Tzfat. We mentioned last time that the Tzfat was a very special place that a lot of mystics went to, and actually we should mention that the Rambam actually says that that the tradition is that the Mashiach, the Sanhedrin, the great judicial body of the Jewish people, 71 elders, it will be reinstituted in the Galil, in the northern Israel, and then we'll move to Jerusalem. So even the Rambam, who's not usually associated with mysticism, even he agrees that northern Israel has a very special significance. It's a forerunner for the Mashiach. So there's also an idea that Elijah the prophet is, of course, from the north. So there's also a mystical point of the north. Last time, we talked about Rav Yosef Karo, who, of course, is known mostly as a legalist, and yet he was quite a mystic himself and believed that he was receiving this inspiration from this inner voice from the Magid, who told him to continue his project. And he was trying to bring the Mashiach by bringing Jewish law to its rightful place and to make it more agreed upon by writing the Beit Yosef, which was summarized by the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. This week, we turn to the Ari. The Ari is not known as Halachas. We'll have to see, was he a legal scholar or was he only a mystic? And he has greatest influence on mysticism, really probably of anybody aside from the one who wrote Zohar or Reb Shimon Bar Yochai himself. And so let's take a look at some of our sources about the great Ari, who's often known as the Ari HaKadosh. Not many people are known as the Holy One. So whenever you say the Ari, you always say Ari HaKadosh, the Holy Ari, and we'll see the great impact that he had on Jewish life to this very day in so many different ways and on Jewish history, even though he lived a very short life, as we'll see in just a moment. All right, so here we go to get started with our presentation. So, the Ari. Today, what's wonderful about the Ari is you can go to his actual grave. I had the privilege of going with my father many years ago and go to the grave of the Ari. It's still accessible. Now, the synagogue of the Ari is not considered exactly where the Ari was, but there is a synagogue in honor of the Ari and the fact that surely he prayed there as well. Now, little history. So his name is Rabbi Isaac Luria. Luria is a famous Ashkenazic name. The Maharal, the Rabbi Luria, who had the golem in the, is a great philosopher from the Maharal of Prague. It's a great name. But they call him Ashkenazi. I mean, he lived among Sephardim, and they call him, the Ashkenazi fellow from, he started in Egypt. However, his mother was Sephardic. So his father from an illustrious Ashkenazic family, and his mother is Sephardic. Why Ari? What's the Aleph? What's the A? So either Ashkenazi, Ashkenazi Rabbi Isaac, or Eloki, the godly, or Adonenu, our master, the Rabbeinu Yitzchak. Okay. By age 8, he had lost both parents, so it was a difficult upbringing. And he was there in Egypt, and he started doing business in Egypt. We actually found in the Geniza, they found a letter where some of his business is actually going on. The Cairo archive of ancient Jewish documents known as the Geniza, we found some that he actually was doing business there. So he didn't start as a rabbi per se, but he was very deeply involved in learning, as we'll see in a moment. Here's just a few reviews of what people have to say. Here's a popular website about Kabbalah. It's at the age of 35, he appeared in Safed, shrouded by mystery and splendor in the span of just 2.5 years until his sudden death. Right, age of 37 and a half, he changed the face of history, birthing a powerful shift in the wisdom of Kabbalah, a shift which opened us the nation, which had opened to us the nation. Now, his normative background, what are his credentials? If you're a mystic, as we showed last week, there isn't this tremendous disconnect between mysticism and law. For instance, one of the greatest geniuses of the last 500 years was the Vilna Gaon. He loved mysticism. Being a mystic and being a Jewish scholar go together. So what are his creds? What are his credentials as far as the normative? And they say that he wrote on Zevachim. Zevachim is a tractate in the Talmud. It's very difficult because it's not about modern practical things. It's about sacrifices. And he wrote it with Bezalel Ashkenazi, who is related to, in Egypt. Bezalel Ashkenazi wrote the Shita Mekubetzes, a collection, anthology of different rabbis who came before. But it was lost in a fire in Izmir, so we don't have it. As a matter of fact, we hardly have anything that the Ari wrote. We'll see later that he found he couldn't write. He was so full of ideas that words would not fit on the page. His students, however, were very prolific, and most famous among them, Reb Chaim Vital, wrote up Shaar Kavanos and many books, volumes and volumes about all the things he learned from him in just a few years. He did ask a question once to Rabbi Yosef Karo. We mentioned last week that in among the questions that Rabbi Yosef Karo was asked, there's one question that was asked by him, like Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt of best of memory. He is known as someone who often asked questions through Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Well, he didn't ask many questions, but we have record of at least one question that he asked the author of the Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Yosef Karo, last week's star of the show. He once asked him a question, and the Rabbi Yosef Karo answered. He started under the Radvaz, a great Egyptian and later Israeli rabbi, but known for his greatness in Egypt. He studied under him as well, so the great potentials. And he began studying the Zohar in Egypt. He spends a lot of time, supposedly according to legend, a lot of time by himself contemplating the Zohar in Egypt. If you just to give you a little sampling, that we actually have a copy of this letter that he wrote. We're not interested in getting deeply into the question, but you see that he was a regular person in his earlier life. It's a question, answer, I mean, a question was asked by Yitzchak Ashkenazi, Hamakuloki, the holy mystic. And the question was, he wanted to know, someone bought something, he thought he was buying it, and then he went away. So here's an actual question in the Shut Avkas Rochel, and the Shalish Juvas in the responsa of Pekaro, an actual question about business that the Ari asked. So he was also a regular, observant, halachic Jew, and a bit of a scholar as well. Perhaps a great scholar. The Chidah was also a great mystic and a great writer, and he also roamed around the world from Egypt and other places, Israel, and he was in Italy. He has a book I have right over here. It's a Shema Gedolim. It's a book about different great rabbis. And it's sort of like an anthology of, I don't know, it's more of a bibliography of different rabbis. So the Chidah, he describes this great rabbi, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, he describes this achievement about the Ari. And in his youth, the Ari, he recorded a Shita, an anthology on tractate Zvachim in the compilation of his mentor, Rabbi Bezalel, and through a great sin, it was burned in the fire of his mirror with all his books, and it was already known that his students asked why he did not compose books of his great Kabbalistic knowledge. Why didn't you write books? If you're the great Kabbalist, we're talking about him this week, he hardly wrote anything. How can you consider someone a scholar if they didn't write anything? You wouldn't get tenure. But he replied that he could not, for wellsprings of knowledge would suddenly open for him, and he lacked the strength to write it. He was so overwhelmed with ideas that to actually write it down would be almost impossible. Couldn't contain the great thoughts in writing. Even speaking was difficult to find a narrow channel with which to speak to them. In other words, could he take all the great thoughts and channel them into words? It was challenging. It was difficult. So that's why we don't have that many writings, but his students have an incredible amount of stuff that they wrote. There are other, aside from Chaim Vital, there are other students who claim the mantle of being a student, and there's a whole debate about who are the true students and what and all that. Okay, moving along. Here's a professor, Lawrence Fine, and I thank Rabbi Torkazina again for some of these sources. He said, Isaac Luria is one of the several most extraordinary and influential mystical personalities that the Jewish tradition has ever produced. Luria may be credited with having helped shape the course of the Jewish mysticism in decisive and profound ways. In other words, sometimes people don't write because they don't have any new ideas. He had tremendous new ideas, which we'll see. Thus, even though Rabbi Luria, called the Ari, lived in the Galilean city of Safed for less than 3 years, from early 1570 till his death at the age of 37, at August 15, or Av, the 5th of Av, 1572, His name is virtually synonymous with the great renaissance of mystical community that took place there between 1530 and 1590. So although he only lived there for 3 years, we all associate Tzfat with the great mystic. During these 6 decades, Safed spawned an astounding array of impressive religious personalities. We're discussing some of them this week, some next week as well. He goes on, this professor goes on, describing, give us a little feeling and overview of the Ari before we get into the details. Among the Kabbalists, however, it was Rabbi Isaac Luria, whose powerful religious imagination and personal charisma served to arouse the most fervent enthusiasm. Not only did Rabbi Luria's presence dominate the Kabbalistic community in Safed during the relatively brief time that he lived there, but following his death, the impression of his personality had lived on, providing grist for a rich legendary tradition. There are many legends about him. Another consequential repercussion of Lurianic Kabbalah is associated with the Sabbatean movement, the false messianic movement in the 17th century. While there has been much debate about the precise nature of the relationship between Lurianic Kabbalah, the Kabbalah that the Rabbi Luria introduced, and Sabbateanism, the false messiah, which went awry and went in an anti-religious direction, antinomian direction, there is no question that the writings of Nathan of Gaza, the central propagandist and religious ideologue of the Sabbatean movement, were thoroughly suffused with Lurianic teaching of the theosophical and mythological type. So there's no question that the rabbi of the false messiah, it was a rabbi named Shabtai Tzvi, lived in the mid-1600s. Most Jews believed that he was the messiah until he landed out converting to Islam. Funny story. Not so funny. And his chief prophet, chief scholar, was Nathan of Gaza. There were Jews in Gaza in those days. There was actually a Jewish quarter in Gaza, I was told by an Arab friend of mine, and in Gaza City. And he was suffused with Lurianic teaching. So there's some relationship between things that were said by the Sabbateans, the Messianic group, and in the 1600s, and Rabbi Luria. So even this great Messianic movement is influenced by this one rabbi who was only in Tzfat for 3 years. Similar observation may be made with respect to popular pietistic movement known as Hasidism. So if we talk about Hasidism, which swept through Eastern Europe, as with Sabbateanism, the exact relationship between Lurianic Kabbalah and Hasidim, you can discuss it. But clearly, Hasidus was influenced by Rabbi Luria. Another way in which Lurianic mysticism exerted influence was in the realm of religious devotion and practice. It went far beyond limited Sally circles. A great many of rituals and customs, as we'll see later, that Rabbi Isaac Luria innovated, along with their Kabbalistic rituals, eventually found their way to Jewish practice in communities in many parts of the world, almost all the parts of the world. Besides their general diffusion, Lurianic devotional practices also became central focus of various Kabbalistic groups. These several examples provide the idea of the wide-ranging and diverse ways in which the life of Rabbi Luria and his teachings influenced the religious culture. Sabbateanism, the greatest upheaval and movement in the 1600s. Hasidism, which goes on to this day, deeply influenced by the Ari. Their Hasidic rabbis always quote the Ari, and many practices of all Jews today influenced by the Ari, as we'll show later. Now, in order to get into the actual Ari and what he actually taught, we need to know more about Sefirot. So some of you are very familiar. I apologize for the basic background. Sefirot are difficult to describe. It's just in a word, let's read this first from Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who was one of the teachers of the Ari, one of the people Ari respected, and from Pardes Rimonim, and then let me comment. It is well known regarding the number of Sefirot. All who were involved in this hidden knowledge have agreed as one that they are 10. Strangely enough, even though God has 13 attributes, there are only 10 Sefirot. 10 is like it's a very important number in math. So the whole world is composed of tens, 10 expressions of God. How do you translate Sefirot? Is it 10 expressions of God? Is it 10 reflections of God? Is it 10 experiences of God? Anyway, God himself, the way the Kabbalists describe it, is indescribable, ineffable. And then there are 10 ways in which we experience God. Sometimes we experience great majesty. That's from God. Sometimes we experience great kindness. It's from God. It's an expression, it's a reflection of these divine attributes, so to speak. So there's no debate in this at all. This is one of the matters in which the covenant has been executed regarding knowledge of the Sefirot. And we have the Book of Creation, an early Kabbalistic book, which is ascribed to our patriarch Abraham, some ascribed to Rabbi Akiva, and is not decided. The words of this book, so deep, so lofty, that they are hidden from the eyes of the intellect, those who examine it, even though there are many different explanations, still we require explanations of all its parts. So there are great mysteries about this, but there are 10 ways God expressed himself. Rabbi Luria actually studied with this Rabbi Corvero for 3 months, and this Rabbi Targazino I mentioned, he's a descendant of Rabbi Corvero. Good. So he describes the Sefirot like this. Man is suited to resemble his creator, or human being resembles their creator. And then we achieve the secret of the higher form, Tselem and Dmut. We can, if we merit, we could achieve some imitation of the divine. If we were to resemble his creator physically, but not in the actions, he would be making the form into a lie. We don't physically resemble God. They would say to him, this is pleasant form, but ugly deeds. The essence of the higher Tselem and the Dmut is in his actions. And of what good is it to be like the higher form, the form of his limbs and not to be created in action? So the main thing is to act like God, not to look like God. God has no form, but our whole body should reflect, all of our deeds should reflect the kindness of God, the greatness of God, the splendor of God, all the different, the humility of God, all that should be expressed in the Jew's behavior, which is a reflection from God. So these are reflections, Sefirot. So all Kabbalists knew before the Ari that there are 10 ways in God is reflected. Good. And then within each way, there are 10 ways in which each way is reflected. Now we're going to get to the main innovations of Rabbi Isaac Luria. Tzimtzum. The first expression, which again has become very popularized today, is the idea of restriction. So here, Reb Chaim Vital, is one of his great students, in the Eitz Chaim, one of his famous books, writes in the beginning, no, before the recipients received and the creations were created, the recipients are the people who were created, there was higher light, simple, which filled all existence, and no space was empty. After all, if God is infinite, he filled all the spaces. All was filled with that simple, infinite light, which is from God. There was neither beginning nor end, but all was a simple light, all equal with total equality. This is what's called the infinite light. And when it arose in his simple will to create the world and to give to the recipients, to bring to light the completeness of his deeds and his names and his kinuyim, whatever he acquired, which was the cause of creation of the world, as explained to us, then he constricted himself at a center point within him, in the actual center. And he constricted that light, and it was distanced to the sides all around that center point. What remained was an open space, an air, an empty space in that actual center point. So you see, we have a problem. The problem is that we know, we say every day, Kadosh, 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 Hashem, Tzvakom, Locha, Shpodo. God is holy, holy. His glory fills the whole world. If his glory fills the whole world, what am I doing here? Especially if I don't act properly, I'm an affront to the glory which fills the God with the world. So there had to be an idea that God took a deep breath, so to speak, and removed himself from part of the world to allow other things to exist. Theoretically, there's no room for anything else. Only God. There's nothing open without God. If we say that God is in everything, we become pantheists. Then I'll say to you, by the way, I say that you should all, you know, do this and that and the other thing. Jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, give me $1 million. Because after all, God is in me. And I say you should do this. And God is in me. So I say it. So I'm like God. So we come to a pantheism unless we say that God took a deep breath. This is one idea of Tzimtzum. So exactly how to understand it, does that mean God literally is not in certain places? What does that mean? God is not physical anyway. Very difficult to understand. And again, these things could lead to great heresy. And that's why a lot of people don't like to study them. And again, it may all be much more of a metaphor than it is something real. In other words, reality, God doesn't need to move away from anything. But in theory, he had to move away. In the Drush Adam Kadmon, also something written by Reb Chaim Vital, he writes that simple, at first, a simple light, Ein Sof, and there was no empty space. And when he wanted to give the recipients, then he restricted himself, and his light went out to the surroundings and was left inside a space that was open. It's an act of deen. Now, you would say that's an act of kindness, right? God said, oh, I want there to be space. Let me move over so there'll be space for everybody else. Actually, no, it's an act of judgment. God had to restrict himself. And that's considered when you hold back, it's judgment. Because let's say generally, I'm a nice guy. I want to be nice to everybody. Sometimes I have to punish my kids. So I have to hold myself back from being so nice and kind and giving. And I have to say, no, you can't have the extra piece of cheesecake for supper because you misbehave. And so God restrained himself to create the extra space for everybody else. I thank Moshe Habertal for this, some of these yellow slides. Now, Reb Chaim Volozhin gives us a cautionary notion. Now, you might think that the writings of the Ari would be something that, you know, if you're Sephardic, they like mystical stuff. If you're Hasidic, they like mystical stuff. But if you're Reb Chaim Volozhin, a student of the Vilna Gaon, if you're a Talmudic scholar from Lithuania, you don't care about the Ari. Not true. But he makes a little limitation. Listen to what he says. Know that everything the Arizal wrote regarding these recondite topics are only metaphors. So he's really into Kabbalah, and into the Ari's Kabbalah. But he says, look, it's only a metaphor. What does it mean that God took a deep breath? What does that mean? And the inner meaning of the matter of the constraining on the channel and the intention regarding these two contexts mentioned above, they're in essence completely one context. The definition of the word constraining here is not a way of referring to leaving a space or transporting from the place, a cause to cause himself to enter and cause himself to connect himself, to actualize a vacant space. Heaven forbid, God can't vacate himself. Rather, the matter is as stated in Bereishit Rabba in the Medrash, she constrained her presence, her face, it was hidden. So it's not that God is not right here, right over here. Is God here? You say, well, it's not that he's not there. Of course, he fills the whole earth, but you can't see him. So this is Reb Chaim Volozhin's interpretation of this idea of the Ari, one of the key ideas that the Ari introduced. If you heard of this idea before, it's the Ari who introduced it. That in the beginning of creation, yes, there was an overflowing of God's will to give to the world and allow us to live. But it was also a restriction. The world begins not with a giving, but with a restricting. Not with kindness, but with a holding back of himself. What does that mean? Reb Chaim Volozhin says, know that it's just a metaphor. I don't know what it means. Then there may have been, then that great light may have come down to the human being. Forgive this little picture here. But the Ein Sof, the God is on the top, above the man. And then the human being, we use the word man generically, of course, it applies to women as well. All have the image of God. God is inexplicable. He is infinite. That's the Ein Sof. That's at the top beyond man. But then he comes down to us. And this is the whole question here. How does the godliness make its way into a rock? How does it make its way into someone like me? How does it go down? So he says, well, first it's infinite. Then it can somehow connect with a crown on top of my head, not my head. And then the Chabad, Chochma, Bina, Vadas, the Chochma and Bina, different types of wisdom in my head. God can certainly connect there a little bit. And then different things are expressed. On one side, kindness. Other side, judgment. And then on the legs, also one side, Hod and Netzach, somehow parallel to kindness and judgment. And then you'll notice the covered parts there. There is an idea of an association of Yesod, of one of the lower Sfirot, one of these 10 of the 10 Sfirot, one of the lower ones being associated with the male private part. And here we get into, you know, why maybe you don't want to study Kabbalah until you're a little older, because there's a lot of private discussions here. And what does it mean? But theoretically, the human being has all these qualities and could reflect God in a beautiful way. However, it didn't work. Going from above, from God restricting himself, the big light, coming into this world of rocks and molecules and skin cells and bones and stuff like that, it didn't work. Here we come to this, the Adam Kadmon was known before the Ari, but here we come to the second innovation of the Ari, the Shvira Kelim, the broken vessels. Although the Sfirot of Tohu shattered and died, nevertheless, a residue of the lights were contained in the vessels remained clinging to the fragments. So what happened? there was God was trying to come down and express himself in a human being. And due to his sin, or due to the fact that the world is not worthy of all the great attributes of God, everything broke. And these are referred by the Arizal as the 288 sparks, nitzotzim. Nitzotz is a singular, nitzotzim is plural. The initial number of fragments in the vessels that broke, the entire process alluded to in scripture, the beginning of God created them, the earth, and the earth was tohu, it was void, and there was darkness. And there was the sovereignty of God hovered. The Arizal explains that the word merachefet, it was hovering, corresponds to two words, meit and rafach, signifying the 288, the numerical value of rafach, had died. There was a breaking. In other words, when the world was created, just like when there's a baby is born, there's a shattering of the waters and stuff happens. So too, when light breaks the world, like the experiment of the seven worlds, when God created the world, the Midrash says that God experimented. He tried this world, that world, until he got our world, seven worlds. So too, says the Ari, when the world was created, he tried to bring down all the godliness into this world, but everything in this world broke, it cracked. But there are some sparks that are still flying around that we could find and we could bring them back together. Based on Gershom Scholem, I would say like this. How do we explain this breaking? As the emanations came down, the first three levels could handle it. The first three levels, right? The wisdom, your head, could handle godliness, right? The rest of the body, but the lower sphere, except for Malchut, except for the kingship, which is all the way on the bottom, except for kinship, could not. The six of the expressions of God could not handle. They could not handle expression in this world, so they broke because it was too strong. The light was too strong. Some light made its way to its source, but others left. The klipot. What's left is evil. The shards that can't handle godliness could be klipot. I was introduced by some of the Chabadniks to the idea of klipat noga. Sometimes there's something that's a shell, it's a dross, but it also has some sparks in it. There are still some points of light in the vessels that can be redeemed. And in the Chabad world, it's called klipat noga, the combination of a klipa and a light, noga being light. So God tried to emanate from infinity into, first God restricts himself so there can be anything that exists outside of him. Then he tries to come into the Adam Kadmon, into the human being. And then as he goes into the lower realms of Tiferet and Chesed and Din and Yesod and Netzach and Hod, it can't handle him. And everything cracks. And then there's sparks that are flying around, and it's our job to bring them back. Chabad.org describes it like this. Due to the intensity and exclusivity of the lights and the inability of their vessels to contain them, the vessels of the lower spherot shattered, and the lights they contained remained above. Fragments of these vessels then fell to lower levels, becoming absorbed in the various worlds, in the world of tohu and chaos. Again, do I fully understand this? No, but this is a little bit of an introduction to the Ari's idea of how the world came into being. Now we get to another idea, and here we're going to get a little more geeky, and for those of you who are familiar with the previous concepts, you might be a little less familiar with this, and I try to get my head around this idea. As we said, the idea of Sfirot, the 10 emanations of God, whatever you want to call them, that's an old idea. It goes way back to the Sefer Yetzirah. It's very old. Certainly the Zohar and the 13th, it's there. However, the Partsufim, a different relationship that develops between these different emanations of God. They're not 10 distinct things. They have relationship one with another. And there are families of Sfirot. That idea is called Partsufim, faces, and it's an Ari idea. Let's see some descriptions of it. The Sfirot of Tikkun were emanated in such a way they worked together and independently and harmoniously as Partsufim. Visages, faces, compound structures of Sfirot. So the Ari is like organic chemist who puts together different structures. The Partsuf is a metaphorical figure of human likeness, a face, used to represent the expansion of the individual sphera, the one a characteristic of God, or group of sphera, into a configuration with, and then each Each face has its own of 10. Everything's related to the 10. Partsufim, what are some of the Partsufim? The Atik Yomim means the ancient one of days, God. Arich Anpin, the one who very he has a long nose. He doesn't get mad very quickly. His nose doesn't get mad. Abba and Ima, as we'll learn in a moment, father and mother. Zer Anpin, the small face. And Nukva, the daughter, or the feminine. As mentioned, the Partsufim work as symbiotic, harmonious systems instead of in discrete, independent, overpowering Nekudot of Toh. So this is a relationship between all of them. What are the different expressions here? Atik Yom means ancient of days. Arich Anpin is related to kindness. And relates to Keter, that crown at the top. Zer Anpin is a sun, the sixth Sfirot. It has to do with those six Sfirot that shattered. And they were born, whatever that means, they come, they emanate from, when things go down from heaven down to us, they go from the Ima and Abba down to us. The Nukva is the female Abba, I don't know. The Ima is the mother, the understanding, and the Zer, and Malchut is related to the feminine Shekhinah. Put another way, watch this. Sfirot, which are 10 distinct things, turn into partsufim or faces or interrelated, molecularly connected pieces of that 7-piece pie. The keter means crown, right? The crown top of the guy's head. The crown turns into, within this vision of the Ari where things fell apart and they moved into something else, they turned into Arich Anpin, into that idea of kindness, and into the idea of the Ancient One of Days, and the idea of Keter, that crown. So the Keter turns into Arich Anpin, Atika and Chesed, kindness. The Chachman Bina, again, the Bina on the right side, and the Chachman on the left side, the different types of knowledge and wisdom and understanding. So what happens to them? They become Abba and Ima. In the Ari's vision of it, they take on a face as mother and father. Well, a mother and father have their children. So what do they beget? How do they go from the divine realm, which is supernal, which is ethereal, which is hard to describe, which we don't understand? How does it come down to us? Well, it goes through the lower Sfirot. Lower Sfirot, again, Chesed, Din, Yesod, Netzach, right? Vura, Yesod, Netzachot, those are the six lower things. So they come down to the lower one. The child of Abba and Ima, the father and mother, is the six lower Sfirot, which are more about judgment. And the final one, the Malchut, the tenth of the Sfirot, of the 10 expressions of God, becomes Nukvah Dizair, another feminine type of image, because Malchut is feminine, Shekhinah, it's a small one. And with all this, it leads to Tikkun. When all these parts of God, so to speak, again, God doesn't have parts. God itself is ineffable, not just indescribable. We're just talking about the ways we experience God and whatever that means. And as these experiences of God come into relationship with each other in various complicated relationships, which I have no idea, way beyond my scope, that will bring a tikkun, which is another new idea of the Ari. If today President Obama and President Biden and Amanda Gorman, everybody knows the word tikkun, right? Tikkun olam, right? That's because it started with the Ari. Before the Ari, there was the idea in the Talmud that sometimes you want to fix the world, you do certain things. But the idea that you fix the world in this kind of way, it definitely goes back to the Ari. Now, when we say that the Ari didn't write much, he did write some zmiras, some songs, to start the meals, the three meals of Shabbos. And it's called Askini Sudasa. Unfortunately, I don't sing it. I'm not mystic. When I go to Shal Shudis or you go to certain people's houses, they sing Askini Sudasa. There's a nice niggun, Askini Sudasa de Mehenusa, Shlemsa, Chedusa de Malka Kadisha, Askini Sudasa de Malka, Doisudasabuk and Kadisha, and Binzati Kadisha, Sinsada Bade. Last part you have to sort of mumble. But anyway, notice what we've got here. So I made a meal, and it's a great joy to God, the king, the Malka, the king, I made a meal. This is the meal of the Garden of Eden, the place of the orchard of apples. Enu Zer Anpin. Remember? Zer Anpin? See the words? Zer Anpin. And the Atika Kadisha. The Zer Anpin was, where is the Zer Anpin? The Zer Anpin was, Zer Anpin is like the daughter of the Zer Anpin is on the bottom there, right? So the Zer Anpin, and also the Atika Kadisha. Which one was that? The Atik Kadisha, the Atik Yomin. So he's saying that to the Shabbos meal, we invite all these expressions of God to come. Because when all these expressions come together, it's going to be great stuff. The male and the female all get together, and it's going to be, in a way, we're sort of fixing God. God in his essence was never ruined. Obviously, God is perfect. But in his expression in this world, it's very flawed, God's expression in this world. But we can put it back together, and that's the tikkun. And he has these songs that he did write. Some scholars say that it's true. He really wrote these. And in some of them, you can see his name, Yitzchak Luria, his name in the acrostic, if you go to the next words in the song. Okay. What is the idea of tikkun? So Moshe Chalamish has a wonderful book on Kabbalah. I highly recommend it. It's one of the few books in Kabbalah that I actually understand. And he said, in the teaching that I read, every individual is a participant in the active process of the world's tikkun by the very act of doing good. This process is called clarifying the sparks. Birur hanitzotzot, you want to get those sparks that came out of the breaking of the vessels. Halat hanitzotzot, to raise the spark. The completion of the process takes place with the arrival of the redemption itself. But it's a process. In the 1500s, when Ari is living, he's starting the process, and we're still working on it. So there's an idea that the redemption is a process. This is also a new idea. Rabbi Moshe Halbertal, who has wonderful lectures on all kinds of things, he said, lives in Jerusalem, connected with Hartman Institute. The role of the religious person is to restore godliness to what it was. When you fix your soul, you fix the whole world. You begin part of that fixing, because your soul itself needs to be fixed. So this idea of tikkun is a deeply Ari kind of an idea. So again, what are the ideas that Ari introduced? Number one, tzimtzum, restriction. God had to take a deep breath to allow room for everything else to exist. Number two, the breaking of the God tried to come down into man's sin. Things didn't work out. There was too much light and everything broke and we're trying to fix it. And there are sparks. We have to find them, reclaim them. Then everything tried to reorganize God, the godliness expression, tried to reorganize in these different complex structures of the 10 emanations of God, and they have different names. And we try to put them back together. And when we do that, it's tikkun, it's the fixing. Then if we mention the Ari, we should also mention Kavanot. What does that mean? Kabbalah, the Ari requires, you may have made Don, another website, Don, says the following. The Kabbalah, the Ari requires Kavanot and Yichudim. We have to put stuff together. We need Kavanah, intent. And Yichudim, we need to put these different pieces together, the Humpty Dumpty. How do we put it together? With mitzvah deeds. And each detail of those mitzvot, again, we're not talking about a mysticism that's denatured, that's disconnected from mitzvot. No, it's through the mitzvot, each detail of those, especially in prayers and blessings, can put the world back together. It can fix the world, tikkun. The words and even the letters and the vowels and of each statement are each directed toward the great tikkun of the sefirot, of the expressions of God in the world, according to the secrets of the Torah, that which is hidden. All of them together combine to a complete array of tikkunim. You do your tikkun, I do my tikkun, and that completeness is essential for it. And any deviation or flaw in the specifics of the yichudim is like a flaw in the corruption of the world. If I don't have proper intent in my prayer, I ruin the whole world. This is the reason for demanding extra care and detail of mitzvot, and the specifics of the text of the prayers. But these Yichudim and Kavanot were essentially the province of individuals of special levels. There were special people, Chassidim, Baal Shem Tov, who knew how to do these kind of intents. What we do is, in Anche Sfard, we use the Sfard prayer book because the Ari figured out that there are great mystical meanings in this prayer book. There are probably great mystical meanings in the Ashkenazic one too. We don't know them. By using the Sfard prayer book, we get to had the benefit of a prayer book which has all these mystical meanings and numerologies that only the Ari and his students understand. How does the Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, he's big on Kabbalah and meditation. So in his book about meditation, he says, what are the Yichudim? You, the lower soul is from this, and he should then meditate on this, elevating the name Eyeh, that's one of the names of God, of the lower world, and binding it to Hashem of Yetzirah, the next world. Adoshem should then be connected with the Yud Kei Vav Kei, the Tetragrammaton of Yetzirah. You take the different names and you put them together. One proceeds in this manner step by step until you reach the Eyeh of Atzilut, the word, the name of God of Eyeh, in the highest level. So you take the different names of God, you think about them in the lower world, there are four worlds, you think about them in the next world, the next one, until you get to the highest level and the highest name, and then you're really going to great places. Do I know how this works? No, but it sounds interesting. Why are we Nusach Svard? Because we're trying to follow the Siddur of the Ari. Why do the Chabad call their Siddur Nusach Ari? Same reason we're Nusach Svard. All of us are trying to get the official reading of the Ari, because if we had the Siddur of the Ari, then we could theoretically combine all those different names of God as we should. I have a Siddur here from the Sephardic Jews from Avad Yosef, and there it has the different, every time you say Hashem's name, there are different names and letters and spellings, and every time you say God's name, you try to put together this letter and this spelling with that spelling, and that's how you fix the world. So today we have some of the prayers from Ari, and he mentions Zeranpin again, one of the names of God that he talks about. Okay. The effects of the Ari on life today. If you've heard of Tikkun Chatzos, Tikkun Leil Hoshana Rabbah, Tikkun Leil Shavuos, it's all stuff from the Ari. If you say these prayers on these specific days, on Hoshana Rabbah, the seventh day of Pesach, of Sukkot, if you say Tikkun Leil Shavuos on the night of Shavuos, if you say these prayers and these readings and these Zohar passages, then you'll fix the world. When if you before you do a mitzvah, you say, I am hereby prepared to do this mitzvah, and I'm going to put together the Yud Kei Vav Kei, the Kutcha Brichu Shchinte. I'm going to put together the Holy One, Blessed Be He, with the Divine Shekhinah, which is feminine. I'm going to put them together. It's all from the Ari. He didn't write those words, but it's from his students. If you say L'chadodi, that's his circle of friends in Sfat. Who wrote it? It has great mystical meanings. Has to do with the bride and the groom coming together, bringing together the Shekhinah on Shabbos. If you're Sephardic, you're super into the Ari. I did a Google a search on my special Bar Ilan project. How many times does the Sephardic Code of Jewish Law, known as the Ben Ish Chai, how many times does he mention the Ari? It goes on for pages. Chasidim? Are you kidding? If I would Google the word Ari in all the Hasidic writings, it would be hundreds and hundreds of times. They're always talking about the Ari. The Ari has a tremendous effect on the Hasidim, Sephardim, and Ashkenazim too. Because we just showed that one of the great founders of Ashkenazic life, the Rav Chaim Volozhin, the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, he too quotes the Ari and talks about it. You want to get a sense of how do the Ari affect Jewish law and basic Jewish practice. So I looked at the Chaye Adam. Chaye Adam is an Ashkenazic book of someone related to the Vilna Gaon. Someone is a student of the Vilna Gaon, the Chaye Adam, Rabbi Danzig. And I did a search for how many times does he mention the Ari? So I'll show you. He says, what about the names of the angels? Should we mention the names of their angels? So the Ari says, you're not allowed to mention them. That's only if you don't need it. But if you're praying, like in certain prayers we pray, we mention the angel of rain, that's okay. So he heard from the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, that he would say those prayers. So I'm not sure he agrees with the Ari exactly, but he sort of modifies what the Ari said. He actually goes more in the direction of angels. He's against trying to be like the Ari. What does he say? He says, you should know that when we say you have intent in your prayers, we mean you should know what the words mean. But you shouldn't try to think of the different names of God, because he says, we're so sinful. And even those who learn the Ari, he says, they don't really understand. They just know the words. The main thing is just to know the words. You won't find one out of 1,000 people who claims to be a student of the Ari, who really knows this stuff. So so he does talk about the Ari, a little bit of a negative context here, but he says he does recognize that the Ari would have great meanings and kavanot in his prayers, just we're not experts in this. He quotes the Ari in a positive light when he says that the Ari says that the reason we were exiled is because we didn't worship God with joy. And he says that we, what does that mean, says the Ari? It means we didn't think about the mitzvot like, wow, I just found a box full of diamonds and gold and emeralds and rubies. If I don't think of every mitzvah in that way, I'm not doing my job. If I say Aleinu and I say, oh yeah, God made us and he made us different from all the nations and you know, we bow down to God and I don't feel excited that I have a treasure, then I'm not worshiping God in joy. So there he quotes the Ari with full endorsement. And then he says some things against some of the students of Ari. Maybe he's talking about the Hasidim. Fine, about how to eat the maror. He affirms some of the Ari's penance, but he's, you know, look, you can't fast too much. You should just learn Torah. Taking out the Torah on Kol Nidre, I didn't have a chance to research it further, but it seems to be also taking out the Torah is the custom of the Ari to take out the Torah during Kol Nidre. Why do we take it out? The Ari, very famous custom. He affirms the Ari's prayers at night. It's a certain prayer, you should say this prayer and that prayer. And then an interesting thing. You know, husband and wife, they live like a husband and wife together, right? But what about the night of Pesach? Is that an appropriate night for that? What about Rosh Hashanah? Is that appropriate? So he says, the Ari says that on the night of Pesach and Shavuot and Rosh Hashanah, he says, those are not good times for that. He says, yeah, but if somebody can't control himself and he's going to do something much worse than hang out with his wife, then he should just be like a regular human being. Don't worry about Rosh Hashanah. So he affirms the Ari, but he says, don't get carried away. Sometimes following the Ari makes it worse than not following the Ari. Also, a lot of people like to quote the Ari that he said that when you start davening, you should fulfill the mitzvah of loving your neighbor as yourself before you start davening. Now, there's a concept we're not going to get into. Indeed, the idea of migration of souls is also a concept that the Ari is very much into. You know, not everybody's into it. I've spoken to great rabbis who told me that, you know, not everybody believes in this. But now everyone believes that one day will be revived, the dead will be revived. But the idea that I might be a reincarnation of someone who needed to come back, that the donkey next to you, that the grass is reincarnation. This is something Ari was really into it. He could read wondrous things about people in the light of a candle of a flame. With the eye he gazed, he was able to see the souls of the righteous, those who had died recently, those who had lived in ancient times. They say that he would look at the grass and he could see whose soul was over there. So again, I don't understand these things, but that's what they say. Gilgul neshamot, also a big idea. Reb Chaim Vital, I don't know if it's completely his idea, but he was really into it. He was an expert in it. He told the Reb Yosef Karo that he made a mistake about his son. He thought it was a transmigration of this soul. It was really a different soul. Okay. He did claim to be the Messiah, son of Joseph. Now, before the Messiah, son of David comes, you have the Messiah, son of Joseph. So, and in many ways, he was. Before Israel was founded, there was Tzfat. There were Jews living in Tzfat. And inspired people later on moved to Israel. In some ways, he did begin to bring redemption spiritually and physically. As we mentioned, somehow some of his ideas got translated into Sabbateanism, in which even after the false Messiah converted to Islam, they continued to believe that he was just fixing the world and bringing up the sparks. You could run into problems of pantheism, although he was not a pantheist, but you could run into problems of misinterpretation. And of course, mysticism without religion is also very poor. It's bereft. And also the idea of tikkun olam without halakha, without Jewish life, which his idea was that the Jewish life would redeem the world. And if people today want to have tikkun without mitzvot, or with only limited mitzvot, that also is a problem that could arise from his idea. So he is tremendously influential, And at the same time, there are a lot of problems that could arise from his teaching. So what did we say? We said that the Ari was one of the great mystics in that he, although he didn't write, he explained to his students all kinds of new ideas. And we explained that the main new ideas were the idea of Tzimtzum, that God restricted himself so the world would exist. The idea that at some point the light of God could not be contained in this world and the things were broken and we need to put them back together and find the sparks that were revealed therein. And the idea that then the expressions of God reorganize themselves. And as we continue to reorganize them through our prayers and thoughts, then we reorganize God's presence in this world and bring a tikkun, which can come about through our prayers and intents. And he had an extensive system of how to do that specifically through the words of our prayers. And that's why to this day, people take it very seriously to have different types of prayers, like in our shul, Nusach Sfarad is specifically designed to follow the wording of the Ari so that we could theoretically get the benefit of all those who understand the mystical meanings in it. We don't, but we use the words which have the mystical meanings of the Ari. So the prayers of the Chabad, of the Sephardic, of the Nusach Sfarad, which is the most dominant form of Siddur in Israel, it all comes from the Ari. Many halachic ideas, even in a book like Chaye Adam, who's not per se a mystic, who's not per se some sort of, he's anti-Hasidic, even his book has many laws from the Ari. Whenever you discuss Jewish law, you often say, well, but the Ari says this. So that comes into play in how to decide the bottom line of Jewish law. You mentioned he's also an expert in migration of souls. And we mentioned that despite all this, there are some problems that could arise and did arise from Ari's ideas. And some of it are Sabbateanism, pantheism, misinterpretation. Again, if you're misnagged, if you're against Hasidism, then you would throw that in as well. But I'm not against anybody. But any event, those are some of the contributions of the Ari, and just an incredible figure. There are many stories about him, like the idea that he could look at a piece of grass and determine what it was, that he heard a certain chazan who wrote many of the zmiros. We have a Yisrael Najara, and he said that he was unbelievable. He said that his songs were elevating the world. But we don't, a lot of the stories, we can't verify that some of the stories, but we do know that he started out in Egypt, that he lived in Sfarad for a very brief time and made such an incredible impact. And those students continue to teach his teachings. And to this day, it's the Ari whose imprint is felt mostly on all of Jewish life. And while some people may, like we read the Rabbi Chaye Adam, perhaps hesitate to embrace some of the ideas of the Ari, but nobody can dismiss him. He is one of the key figures. And his ideas had this tremendous impact and continue to inspire and to also raise problems to this day. So that concludes our formal presentation. I thank everyone for joining us. At this point, if anybody has any questions, we'll take questions.
Well, Rabbi, do you think on the whole that it was a positive development, the Ari? I mean, I enjoy reading it, but for the Jewish people, is it hard to know on the whole if it was, I mean, the Shabtai Tzvi incident was pretty terrible.
Right. No, I think as a whole, it is. Absolutely. I'm a big fan. I don't know where to put him exactly in my own life. His life was so different from my life. My life is focused on classic Jewish texts, understanding them, and following Jewish law. He's living in a different plane with the creation and trying to fix the way God expressed himself in this world. A whole different plane. I don't know where to put him in my life. But I know that I can't live without him because he's made such a mark on so many different aspects of our daily existence. So the inspiration that he had was tremendous. And not all the students became, as we'll see next week, we're going to deal with Ma'arit and Mabit. They were not extreme. So not everyone in Sfat was, you know, went off the page and went into a different realm like the Ari. The Ari was very extreme. But many of the people who were inspired by the Ari's presence had such a wonderful impact on the whole community of Sfat. But many people just continue to be right, more standard scholars. Yeah, I think the Ari sets a standard for us to envision, you know, someone who could try to change the world. And that idea of tikkun olam, you know, while, you know, in Orthodoxy we have a mixed relationship with the idea of tikkun olam as it's expressed most by some of the people mostly in the non-Orthodox world, because sometimes it's sort of as opposed to ritual practice. In the Ari, it's all part of ritual practice. That when you make Kiddush on Friday night, it's like the whole world changes. And this idea that a Jew can have an impact on the whole world, that certainly is a very inspiring idea. And I think, you know, there is something to that idea has really touched a lot of people. A lot of Gentiles were like, that's a great idea. The thing is that it's not just in the practical realm of, like, you know, help the poor people in your neighborhood. It's also in the mystical realm that fixing your own soul is also a very significant activity. We can't sell ourselves cheap that fixing someone else, if I provide for someone who's poor, I provide for them. Of course, a mitzvah to give to the poor, there's no question about that. But that the whole fixing of the world is all about someone else, giving to someone else. It could be reaching out to others. But there's also a tremendous fixing that's done in my own head, my own soul, and my own self. And to the extent that the tikkun moves into, you know, the outer realm rather than the inner, you know, that's not what the Ari had in mind. But every good deed, any good thing, it's amazing. And you know, a lot of great things are done in the name of tikkun olam. It's beautiful. So in a word, yeah, no, it's definitely a positive phenomenon. But I just don't know what to do with them. It's just so otherworldly. Other comments or questions from Jason or anyone else?
Well, I'll just finish by, I really enjoyed the class. And I think, you know, for me, the Rambam is amazing, but he's so elitist and abstract that the Ari makes things very practical. And for the people, there's not really a divide between the elite and the masses. So that's what I really love about the Ari. And I think you brought that out today with the sources.
Well, not sure everyone can understand the Ari. And there's even Hasidim who adopt the Ari prayer book in one form or another. You can call it Ari, Sfar, whatever you call it. It's the same thing as the Ari. They say, we're just plain people. We don't really understand what special meaning there is in this paragraph of, you know, V'yatzmach Burkane as opposed to not V'yatzmach Burkane. We don't really understand. But he did. And then we're going to use those words. So it's almost like you can touch the Ari. You're right. The average person can touch the Ari, but you don't necessarily understand the Ari. There's sort of an interesting dichotomy there. No? What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, interesting dichotomy. Yeah, I think there's the level of kavanot that we don't understand, but the idea that you can raise sparks and everyone can do that, whether you're a scholar or whether you're a layperson at your dinner table, everyone's lifting sparks. I think that equalize things, where I think the Rambam kind of missed that in the Mor Nevuchim, made it like very elitist spiritual path. And I'm reading Nefesh HaChaim, which also makes Torah learning very spiritual. And I think Rabbi Nachman turns learning into prayer. So I think all that comes from the Ari about you're doing something with your learning. You're not just trying to become a greater scholar than other people, or there's not that divide between the elite and the masses. I really love that about the Ari and the mystics.
I hear you. But I think there's something within the Ari's message that the average person can relate to and can tap into. Right? When I make Kiddush, I can fix those worlds. Right? When I just do a simple mitzvah, I say, with this mitzvah, somehow, I don't understand how, but somehow it's going to bring the kucha and the brichu and the shchinte. It's going to bring them all together, and the world's going to be great, and it's going to be fixed, and you know, it's terrific. So I don't know how that works, but you know, the Ari said it, so most Jews say it before they eat their matzah, you know, they say it. The Yichudim, we try to bring the pieces back together. And you're right, every Jew has a role in that. That's good.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you for joining us. Great to see everybody. And yeah, anybody wants to final greetings or anything? Good to see everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.